everybody. My name is Rachel. I'm alcoholic. And just to get the garbage out, my sobriety date is December 1st, 1978. That makes it 27 years, 3 months, and 30 days. But I'm the only one that's counting. I'm certain of that. My home group is the Select Speakers Group in Bakersfield, California. If you're ever through Bakersfield and want to go to a meeting, go to that one. It's a little rough in Bakersfield. But you're more than welcome to come there. I want to thank Bob for asking me to come and share with you guys. I kind of like this stuff. I used to talk too long in participation meetings. So I just hope I don't talk too long tonight, you know? I love Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the first thing off the top. I'm just a fallen down, tore up from the floor up, street walking, wine drinking entrepreneur. Somebody told me that I needed to quit saying ho. I don't understand. What you mean? I come to an AA meeting and I'm scoping. Are one of you my future ex-husbands? I'm certain of it. I'm really glad to be here. Like I said, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, when, you know, people like me, we just don't make it. We don't make it without Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so glad that Alcoholics Anonymous is upside down, according to the rest of the world. Because the sicker you are, and bet you, baby, I am, I'm sicker I are, the better off you are here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I got to come to Alcoholics Anonymous quite by accident. It really was an accident. I was not alcoholic. I just was taking a little vacation at Norwalk State Mental Institution. It was my third vacation. I don't understand. But without Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm certain that I wouldn't be anywhere but there. Or I might end up being one of those people that you see pushing carts down the street. Because I have the makeup that doesn't die. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's all right for me to be alive. I am alcoholic, and you're going to hear from great authorities in Alcoholics Anonymous that you ain't supposed to say this. It's my parents' fault. It's their fault that I'm alcoholic. I am Indian, English, Irish, and Mexican. I had nothing to do with it. I needed a drink. So it is their fault. And that's just the way it is. I would love to come up here and be able to give you all kinds of tips and hints on how to stay sober, but that's not in my makeup. I'm just going to tell you how this tacky old hoe got sober, and I might tell you a little bit about what happened to me once I got sober. So another thing that I want to tell you is that anything that I say here is strictly from my experience and my opinion. And I could leave here tonight and I'd be all wrong. So what you hear here, I just hope is good enough to keep me sober one more day. I come from a long line of alcoholics. I had alcoholics all over. I mean, you know, you've heard the, oh, I have alcoholism runs through my family, and then you've heard it gallops through mine, that's what it did with mine. I'm alcoholic. My daddy was an alcoholic. My grandma was an alcoholic, and her family beyond that was alcoholic. My grandmother was married to an Al-Anon, But he didn't know that's what it was. He just was beaten up by alcoholism around him. My mom was practically destroyed by alcoholism, but she survived. Thank God. When I was a little kid, I remember taking my, what I thought was my first drink, but I don't believe it was my first drink. My first drink that I fought for, I was 3 years old. My dad was standing in the kitchen door, and he had a glass of vodka, and I fought him for it. And I fought him for it because I knew that it had a profound effect on me when I took that drink. I knew that. And I fought him for it, and I fought him for it, and I fought him for it, and I got it. And that's just the way that it was. That's the first drink that I remember fighting for. That's the first drink that I say that I took that I really needed. My mom and dad were together until I was 5 years old. I have two sisters that are younger than me, and so I was the oldest. My mom had me when she was 16 years old, which isn't strange. It's just not talked about. She had me when she was 16. When my mom and dad divorced, I was 5. That made her 21. And she decided to leave. She divorced my father, bought a house across the street from my grandmother, and I didn't see her, really, except off and on until I was about 12 or 13 years old. I can't really give you an exact time, but I was about 12 or 13 years old when my mom came back. I would see her on occasion. I think one of the biggest resentments that I had is that I loved my mom and I wanted my mom to love me. And when she would come back in, she would leave. And something strange happened to me when I was very young. It was too hard for me to love her. It was too painful. So I ended up hating her. So I started hating her when I was very young because she would never leave. She would never do anything but leave. As a result, I raised my two sisters from the time I was 5 until I was about 12 years old. And that's not a very good thing. Because I don't know what I'm doing. My mom worked two jobs. At night, she was a bartender in the country western bars in Bakersfield, that's where I'm originally from. And she would come home whenever she felt like it. You know, it's really tough raising children. So she would take vacations and come home whenever she felt like it. Thank God my grandmother was across the street. Sometimes our home would have no electricity. Sometimes we would have no food. I know that we had gas all the time because they couldn't turn it off legally. Otherwise, that would have been the thing. Sometimes I would feed my sisters fried bologna sandwiches and pack them in lunches to go to school with. And sometimes I would give them cornstarch and water with a little sugar because that's what we had in the house. And that was the very beginnings of my life, being the adult in my home, raising my two sisters, and my mom gone. My father is a falling down, puking drunk. That's why she dumped him. And that's the way life was back then. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks a little bit about somewhere in the past I made a decision based on self that would later put me in a position to be hurt. And I believe that during that period of time between 5 and 12 years old, I could be wrong, but during that period of time, I made some decisions that altered the course of my life for the worse. Back then, like I said, I was raising my two sisters, and there was no real adult around that I could lean into, and I was afraid most of the time. I was afraid of people. I didn't mix well with kids. I was different. I was afraid. I just didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't have anyone to give that to. In Bakersfield, occasionally there are some really fierce storms. And I remember when I was about maybe 6 or 7, maybe 8 years old, there was a storm in that town that just rocked. It shook the walls, and there was thunder and lightning, something out of Cecil B. DeMille. It was one of those storms. It was a horrible storm. And I remember going into the house and getting a can of Ronson's lighter fluid and a knife. And I took this can of this knife, and I carved a cross in the dirt in front of our steps, and I filled this cross with lighter fluid, and I set a match to it. And I kneeled next to this burning cross because I was terrified. I knew that if there was a God, he needed to see that I was there. And somebody came up behind me and popped me in the head. Stupid! You think God's going to pay any attention to you? You know what I did? That's the end of God. And from that point on, I began to control my own life. I made decisions as if I was the only one that made any difference to. Back then, when I got particularly afraid, I would run across the street to my grandmother's house. And that's where the magic was. It was across the street in my grandmother's house. I would find my grandma in the yard. And grandma was... Grandma had a little house that was completely hidden by garden and trees and vines and all kinds of good stuff. You couldn't see the house, not even with the light on at night. You couldn't see the house because it was so thick with plants that she took care of. And I knew where to find her. I'd go running through her little trails that she had in her yard, and she'd be in there digging circles around her roses and watering her roses. And I'd go over and I'd say, "Grandma, are you all right? You don't look so good." And she'd go, "Ooh." And she'd grab my hand and we'd run off into her house and she'd stop in the front room where Grandma's little wicker basket is. You know the kind of wicker basket I'm talking about, the kind with a handle and a brocade top, and you open it up and there's things to put things together with in there. Well, Grandma would grab that basket, and she'd grab my hand, and we'd dash off into the kitchen, and she'd set that basket down on the kitchen table. She'd open it up, and inside that little basket was little white boxes of medications that she got from Kern General Hospital. You see, my grandmother had been diagnosed with a nervous breakdown, and my grandmother's nervous breakdown was snakes and spiders crawling out of the wall. that's why she took those pills. So if I told her, "You don't look so good," I guess she thought they were coming. She better go fix that real quick. You know what I mean? My grandma was, oh my God. You hear it from speakers all over the place. If I hadn't had that one person in my life, I would never have known unconditional love. And that's what I got from my grandmother. My grandmother, though, was a terrible drunk. She was a terrible drunk. That nervous breakdown, before they gave her the medication, she would see snakes and spiders coming out of the wall, so she'd go through the walls to go get them. She was going to get them. And my grandfather got so tired of the holes, fixing holes in the walls in their little house, that he just said, "The heck with it, I'm not doing it anymore." So the holes in the walls became fly holes. That's what they were called. We had fly holes in Grandma's house. Grandma would open up those boxes and take pills out of them, and she'd line them up on the edge of the table. And she would grab a mason jar and fill it with water, scoop up those pills, put them in her hand, toss them in her throat. She'd take that mason jar, she'd take a drink, and then she'd do what you and I do. Can you feel it? Grandma would take those pills, and she would just look at me and smile, because everything's going to be all right, you know? And I'd get all excited. I still get goosebumps when I think about that, because I'm just a kid. I'm just a kid, and I know that the party's about to happen. Grandma would go into her dish room, and she'd get two cups and two saucers, one for her and one for me. And she'd get those two cups and saucers and set them on the table. And then she'd go and reach into the refrigerator. And looking at me and smiling, she would reach into the door of that refrigerator, and she would pull open an unopened fifth of Seagram 7. She'd hold that bottle like this. Oh. And I'm sitting there with, you know, I got green slime coming out of the corners of my mouth. I'm ready for this, right? And I don't know what you think, but what I think is this. The most beautiful sound, the music of the spheres, is nothing more than the sound of paper breaking on an unopened bottle. Grandma would undo that cap and I could smell it. Oh my God, can you smell it? And I'm sitting there just watching her. I'm thinking, hurry up. Grandma would look at me and kind of smile. She'd put some in her cup. And then she'd look me straight in the eyes and she'd put some in mine. And she'd top it off with black coffee and she'd say, "You drink your damn coffee black. It's a mean world and you've got to be tough." And I go, "Okay, Grandma." Boom! And then I'd get it. And then she'd fix us another. And I recognized Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here, because you do the same thing. Grandma would take that second drink, and we'd be there drinking, and it turned out to be a little bit like an AA meeting. Grandma was the main speaker. She'd tell me what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And then he... And I showed them. My grandmother was born in 1901 in Texas, and she couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. But in the meantime, while she was there, my grandmother was a carnival girl. At least that's what she told me. I don't know if it was the second drink or the third. But Grandma was a carnival girl in Texas. She was a hula. She did the hula. Everybody thought she was Hawaiian. She was so proud. They thought she was Hawaiian. And I don't know about you, but alcohol has a strange effect on me. It makes me smarter than you. You know what I mean? And Grandma would get up and she'd start to do the hula. And I would tell her, "No, Grandma, you don't do it like that. You do it like this." And then she'd tell me about being buried alive for 7 days. I'm thinking, yes, I'm going to do that too. And then she was a can-can dancer in the gold rush in Alaska. And we've already had a third or a fourth cup of coffee. Good coffee. And Grandma'd start do the can-can, and I'd do the can-can with her because I did it better than her. I mean, booze did something magic for me. Now, not all the time, but often enough to remember, my grandma would say, "Do you hear music?" I'd say, "What?" I'd get a little scared when she'd say that. Because if she heard music and I didn't, the snakes and spiders were coming, and I am having none of that. And I'd say, "No, Grandma, I don't." She said, "Well, hell, why don't we get some on?" I said, "Okay." And she'd fix us another drink, and we'd leave the AA meeting, and we'd go to the AA dance. It was fabulous. It was absolutely fabulous. My grandmother would put on some of that Chuck Berry. She liked Chuck Berry, brown-eyed, handsome man, sweet little 16. Not all the time, but she'd play her favorite song. She almost committed suicide over this one. The Big Bopper. When he died, she died. You know? She loved Chantilly Lace. Now, I got to tell you what my grandma looks like, because my grandma was a real alcoholic. You know, alcoholic women, they wear muumuus with them big flowers and stuff. Oh. Anyway. Wait a minute. You remember in the 80s when when the Mexican women used to wear the hairdos, the skyscrapers? Grandma had a skyscraper, but it wasn't held together with Aquanet. Mine is. But Grandma wore her muumuu and her skyscraper. It was from bending over doing roses, and her hair was like this. She wore a bun on the top of her head, And Grandma wore brown and tan Oxfords because she was out digging in the yard all the time. And she wore Grandpa's socks, you know, the ones with the big ankles. And she'd take a step and the sock would follow. And Grandma would put on Chantilly lace, and we'd wiggle and walk, and she'd giggle and tuck, and she'd pop that pin, and she'd swing her ponytail around. It was absolutely fabulous. Have you ever been to an AA dance where you felt that good? I never did. You remember that AA dance where you stood there and they stamped your hand with ink that didn't come off for 3 months? They charge you $5 to torture you. You get in that room and the music is bouncing on the inside of your chest, and you go lean up against the wall. And you got two thoughts in your head. Just two. God, I hope somebody asks me to dance. God, I hope nobody asks me to dance. And you pay $5 for torture. I mean, excuse me. Grandma and I didn't have that trouble. We just danced and carried on. Now, not all the time, but often enough for me to remember, my grandmother would take that drink. And that drink is why we're here. My grandmother would take that drink, and everything would change. Everything would change. My grandmother's mood would change. My grandmother would start to cry. She'd change the music. And there was an album that my grandmother used when she took that drink. My grandmother played an album. It was Arthur Lyman's Taboo was the name of the album. And on one cut, it's Red Sails in the Sunset. And she put on that song, and my little grandmother would stand there crying. And she would tell me, this little kid, will you play this for me when I die? Now, we're talking about the only good thing in my life. We're talking about the only one that I know loves me. And she's talking about leaving me back here by myself. And she starts to cry, and I start to cry. And we hold each other, and we rock back and forth because I don't know what to do. We don't know what to do. Neither one of us know what to do. We just rock back and forth. Back then, I began to tell her those lies that I started telling people from that point until I died in Alcoholics Anonymous. I told my grandma, please don't leave me. I'll change. I'll be good, Grandma, just please don't leave me. And we'd rock back and forth because there was nothing else to do. We didn't know. We didn't know that there were 12 golden steps. We didn't know that there was a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. We didn't know that there was a way of life that would work for us. We didn't know. We just stood there and rocked back and forth, and I started telling her those lies of how I was going to change and how I was going to be good and I was going to make everything better if she just please wouldn't leave me. You know, that was the way it was. I didn't know. She didn't know. When I was about 12 years old, my mom came home. She'd been married, divorced, married and pregnant. And she took me away from the only good thing I'd ever known. And about that time, I met people like you. People like you that found that alcohol was a better way of life. And I found you, and I stayed with you from the time I was 14 years old. I got in so much trouble, I was immediately arrested because I was not coming home. My first attempted suicide was at 14 years old. At 14 years old, I was dying from alcoholism, and my mother decides to take me to a psychiatrist, and his solution to my problem at 14 years old was a frontal lobotomy. I get to Alcoholics Anonymous 14 years later, and I find out I didn't need a frontal lobotomy. I needed a bottle in front of me. If I could find that jerk, if I could just find him. I heard he moved to Tehachapi or something. I'm going to find him one of these days. Pow! To the moon. I don't know. I made my mother all those promises one more time. I'll be good. I promise. I'll change. I'll do whatever you want. I promise you. I promise you. Just please don't let them do that to me. And what I did instead was I got worse and I got worse and I got worser. My mother had married a man that was alcoholic. One more alcoholic in her house is all she needed, only he was violent. My mother was sick and tired of my crap and sick and tired of his crap. And one day she says, I ought to send you to your father. And I thought, why don't you? You're not doing me any good. And with that, she shot me off to my father, where I lived for about 3 months. And in those 3 months, enough damage was done between my father and I for me not to speak to him for 32 years. Because he was a drunk like me. And I needed to blame him. I needed to blame him. My mother had. Sounded like a good idea. About the end of that stay that I was there, they kicked me out of high school because I was too much trouble, and they sent me to East Bakersfield High, a continuation night school. And one night I was out because I without a drink, I don't know how to be around people, and I was hiding, having a cigarette by myself, and I was surrounded by 10 guys that if they'd have offered me a drink first, I'd have enjoyed what they wanted me to do. But instead, they hurt me, they beat me, and they left me there. When someone found me, they called in the sheriff's department, and to make matters worse, not only was I beaten and used like that, but I was dragged from classroom to classroom to classroom. And I got to tell you, that night I had blood dripping through my coat sleeves where they had beaten my face, and the blood was coming through my coat sleeves, and they walked me from classroom to classroom to classroom for me to point them out. And I swore that I would never let anything like that happen to me again. My mom, when she dropped me off at my father's house, had packed a few things of her own, and she moved my little baby brother and my two sisters to a city called Long Beach. And when she heard what had happened to me, she came and got me and decided to take me home with her, where I would be safe. When you leave Bakersfield, you go up a set of mountains, and then you go down into the valley. And I think for me, the most beautiful sight that I've ever seen from that day to this is going from that horrible valley that I was living in into San Fernando Valley and seeing all of the beautiful lights. It's spiritual for me to look at it. That night, it was filled with stars and big puffy clouds, and I was looking at those lights, and I was thinking, of course, that this was good, but I was afraid because I knew that I wasn't wanted as a child. How was this going to work? And I remember that night my mother reached over, and she put her hand on mine, and she said, "Baby, this time it's going to be different. In a new town, with a new school and new friends, you're going to be all right. We won't ever have to visit that kind of crap again. We're going to be okay. This time it's going to be different." You know, I wanted to believe that. She wanted to believe that. Neither one of us knew. Neither one of us knew. I remember going to Long Beach, and it was worse than hell. I got there, and I wasn't drinking. I got there, and I had no friends. I got there, and I had no family. I was an embarrassment already. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with me. I couldn't look people in the eyes. And I remember one afternoon I'm standing on a corner, and the big book describes it best in A Vision for You, where it talks about being surrounded by the four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And that's what I felt that day when I stood in that corner. And I didn't know that my life was going to change. I didn't know. I thought it was just going to stay this way forever. And this guy... "One of you, I'm sure," drove by, and you caught my eye. And I thought, oh God, what does he want? And he went around the corner, and he came back. And I'm choking, because I don't know how to talk without a drink. And this guy looks at me, and he says, "You want a ride?" I said, "Uh-huh." And I got in. So we go down a couple of blocks. He says, you want to come to my house? And I'm not able to talk, so I just tell him, uh-huh. And he says, okay, let's go. And so we got to his house, and we stood in his doorway just about ready to go into his house. I can take you to that place to this day. To this day, I know exactly where that place was. And we stood in his doorway, and he says, would you like a drink? What'd I tell that man? Uh-huh. And he sat me down on his couch, and he put on some music. And I'm not, you know, I'm 15 and a half years old. I'm 15 maybe. And this guy puts on an opera like I'm sophisticated or something like that, you know? He puts on an opera called Aida. Now, Aida who? And then he goes into his kitchen and he comes out with two long stem glasses of white wine. One for him and one for me. And we start drinking and he starts telling me about Aida and what she's doing and where they're going and what they're fighting and all this stuff. And somewhere about the end of it, I just kind of lost interest. I'm not much for classical music. I was getting laid in a classical way. It didn't matter to me. I was having fun, baby. And that was it. That was it. When it was time for me to leave, I didn't want to go. But as you know, I have a couple of drinks, and I'm adult, I'm mature, I'm smart, I know what I'm doing, and I reach my hand out, and I thank him for a great time. And when he put his hand in mine, he put a piece of paper in my paw. And because I have had a couple of drinks, I'm not going to look to see what it is, not so that he thinks I'm interested. You know what I mean? It's that violent twist that they talk about. I don't want you to know. Now, if I hadn't had a few drinks, I probably would have thrown myself around his ankles and begged him to let me stay. But I hadn't, I'd already started drinking, so I stood there and thanked him. I remember getting into his car, and he dropped me off on that horrible corner where he picked me up. And I remember waving as he went by and turned the corner. And then I opened up my hand. I hoped and prayed that day that it was his phone number, because I'd have done anything to do that again. And when I opened up this paw, what I found was not his phone number. What I found was a $5 bill. Do you know that 20 of those make 100? It does. Did you know that? Holy smoke. I've just become an entrepreneur. And I knew exactly how I'd gotten that $5. I knew exactly what I had to do to get another. And I charted my course from that point on. I knew exactly what to do. You stand on the corner, you catch his eye. He comes back, he takes you to his house. You have a few drinks, you listen to some opera. You get $5. I thought, man, this is magic. This is magic. Soon as I got that all figured out, I made a decision. One that was going to haunt me into my sobriety. And the decision goes like this. I don't need you anymore. I don't need friends. I don't need family. I don't need my mother. I don't need school. I don't need nothing, baby. I know how to take care of me. I know how to take care of me. And with that decision and that newfound talent, I head myself directly into the gates of insanity and death, because that's where people like me go. Now, before I go any further, I got to tell you, I found out real soon after that that I was highly underpaid. So if you're going to offer me your phone number, it better be your phone number. By the time I'm 17 and a half years old, I have my own apartment. I'm living in Hollywood. I'm working Sunset with a vengeance. I'm 17 years old, standing in front of Hollywood High with a stack of books that I got from the Salvation Army. Hey, baby. I'm making $200 to $500 a night if I stay home. And if I go out, I make even more. I'm a talent beyond belief, baby. But something strange started happening to me, and I can't tell you exactly how it started or when it started, but it started happening to me. All of a sudden, I knew it was time for me to go out, and I was afraid. And I didn't know how to handle that. I remember one night trying to fix my hair. I couldn't get my hair put together. I remember trying to change my makeup, washing my hair, doing this, going into the closet, finding the cleanest dirty clothes that I could find so that I could get out and back to work. And I just couldn't put it together. And then I remembered, there's a liquor store right downstairs. And I remember going down and thank God for the wino. There was a wino standing in front of the liquor store. And I said, would you buy me something? And he said, what would you like? And I stood there, checking out the wine list. I will have a bottle of Pagan Pink and Pear White. And he said, you got it, babe. And I remember he went in there with my money, and he came back out with a short bag with two long neck bottles of that wine sticking out. And I remember just seeing it in his hands, I felt better. And I held those bottles like my grandma did, and I felt even better. And I got upstairs, and I popped one of those caps, listened to that beautiful sound, and I took a drink. And I took one look in the mirror, and it was bam, the girl is back. You know, you could see the hotel lights flashing in my lips from the extra layer of lip gloss from across the street. It's, baby, she's hot tonight. And then I remember another time not long after that I took a drink, and something very strange happened to me then. I took that drink and I started to cry, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And I took another drink and it made it worse. It didn't make it better, it made it worse. So I took another one and it got even worse. And I didn't know what to do. So I started cleaning my house because I didn't know what to do. And I remember when I finished cleaning my little apartment, I was standing in front of the kitchen, the bathroom sink, and it was clear and white. I'd never cleaned it that good. And I remember looking in the mirror, and I had cleaned that mirror. And I saw something that scared me so bad that I opened up my medicine cabinet and I pulled out a straight razor and I slashed this wrist and I took 25 sleeping pills because of what I'd seen in the mirror. I went up 5 flights of stairs to the top of my building and I jumped because I couldn't stand what I'd seen that night. Now, as God would have it, not I, there were 2 police officers on the top. They saw me make that dash across the roof of my building, and they grabbed me by my arms, and my feet swung out, and my body slammed against the side of that building. And that was the first time in my life that I ever had to beg, because that night I begged them to please let me go, because I couldn't stand what I'd seen that night, and I couldn't have told them what it was that I'd seen, because I was too humiliated by what I'd seen. I knew that night when I looked in that mirror what I had become. I saw what alcohol had done for me. I'm 17 and a half years old, and I'm an embarrassment to my family. I'm ashamed to a community that I live in. I'm an embarrassment. I'm nothing but a cheap whore. That is what I'd become, and I was not raised to be that. And for the next 10 years, I tried to destroy that whore because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what else to do. I would commit suicide as often as I could. I began to find out that my suicide attempts didn't work, so I started getting people to kill me. At one time, when I was 20 years old, I was stabbed 17 times. They broke my jaw. They knocked out my teeth. When the police kicked in the door, and I'll never forget this for as long as I live, when the police kicked in the door, there was a man sitting on my back, cutting off my head with a hunting knife, and a second man holding my arms because I was fighting too hard. And when those police kicked in my door because somebody called about the noise, when those police kicked in my door, they jumped up and stood still. The police officer turned me over to see who I was. And when he saw who I was, he told those 2 men, or I should say they, there were more than 2. They told those men, get the hell out of town, Maybe you've gotten rid of some of the scum we got here. I'm 20. And I'm scum. And all I need is another drink. All I need is another drink. I just need another drink. By the time I'm 21 years old or so, I meet a man, and after 3 years of a lovely dance that we did together, he told me, you were a pig when I met you, you'll be a pig when you die. And for the next 2 years, I walked the only way that I could. I walked those streets, and I drank, and I died, and I drank, and I died, because I didn't have anything better to do. I didn't know that there was another way. I didn't know that I was suffering from the disease of alcoholism. I knew I was bad, I knew I was dirty, and I knew that people like me shouldn't be on this earth. And there was no way that I could kill myself, and there was no way that I could get somebody to kill me. And I remember on the Monday after Thanksgiving of 1978, I took a drink. And it hit my belly and shot straight out. It shot straight out, and I thought, oh my God, what's happened to me? And I took another, and it shot straight out, and I took another, and the same thing happened. And I had a fifth of vodka, and I left four fingers in it. And I had a six-pack of Colt 45, and I thought, I'm going to drink that instead, and maybe when I can be able to manage another drink, I'll drink the rest of the vodka. But I couldn't, because I took a drink of that. And I'm telling you, I thought I had just seen The Exorcist. I knew there was something wrong. I had just seen that. I knew there was something wrong, and I knew there was no way for something like that. I knew that day, after taking that much booze into my system and unable to keep any of it down, I knew that day that I'd never be able to drink again, and I had no idea what to do. I remember 2 years prior, a lady had been very kind to me, and she was a psychologist, and she told me that if I ever needed any help, please call her. And I called her on the Monday after Thanksgiving of 1978, and I told her, I believe I've lost my mind. Can you help me? And she came to my house and waited through the life that I had been living. And there was trash, there were broken bottles, there was rotten food, there was a sink that was covered with scum. There was a chicken that I had cooked maybe a month before walking around on the stove. I don't know. It was green. And I was dirty. I was dirty. I was so dirty. I stunk. And she came in and she put me in the back seat of her car. Her and this other woman named Willie Mae came to pick me up, and they took me to Norwalk State Mental Institution. And I got to tell you, when they put me in that back seat of that car, I thought, thank God. Thank God. Thank God. It was perfectly all right for me that day to spend the rest of my life in Norwalk. It just really didn't matter. It did not matter anymore. I got to that nut house, and they put me in a room with a black hooker and a psychotic break. And I watched her as her pimp was beating her up. I watched her throwing herself against the walls, and I got frightened that day. I was scared to death that day they would find out that I wasn't as sick as she was, and they would send me back. That was my big fear. The next day, they put me in a room with about 18 beds, and there were two women there, and they put me in this bed, and I'm looking, and all of a sudden, I see all these guys coming, and I'm thinking, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. I don't know what you've been like after a few days without booze, but I was weak. He could have done, there was a man there, it was 6'14", I think. He was, I looked at him, and I thought, what am I going to do? And I asked the lady next to me, and she says, oh, baby, I wouldn't worry about it. He couldn't get it up if he had a rope tied to it. I just kind of went, whew. It was safe. It was safe. That Friday, that was on a Tuesday, on a Friday, they tell me, I want you to go to this thing upstairs we're having. I said, oh, really? I said, yeah. I said, what is it? And this guy named Jack Delmont said, Rachel, we've got the father of a very famous movie star. He's kind of come up and talk to you in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told him, what? I'm not alcoholic. Why would I want to go? And he said, Rachel, But he's the father of a very famous movie star. He said that twice. I'm thinking, do I have loser tattooed on my forehead or something? You know, if I wasn't such a loser, they brought the movie star, right? No, they're going to bring his dad. I'm a loser, right? And I'm telling him, no thanks. No thanks. And he says, all right, Rachel, let's put it to you this way. Either you go or you go. What's it going to be? All right. Now, I'm not looking very good. I'm a few days off of booze. When I stopped drinking, I was taking a 3-month supply of diet pills a week. I was taking a 2-month supply of sleeping pills a week, you know, just to make sure that I was getting enough booze. I was drinking 2 quarts of vodka a day to just calm down the amphetamines. And I was drinking all the beer I could. And I love Gallo White Port, so I was doing that too. So I'm just a little pig. And I'm sick. I'm very sick. You know, those first few days that I'm in that place, I'm trying to get the dirt off of my feet. I don't know where it came from. My feet were dirty. I was just dirty. And they take me up to that room. I'm wearing sanitized green pajamas. You ever seen those things? They stink, too. And I got dirty feet. I have an upper denture because of one of my adventures before I got sober. My upper denture on that day was in 3 pieces, a left, a right, and a middle. And I had 4 front teeth missing. And, you know, they wondered why I wouldn't say anything. Are you kidding? With 3 pieces loose in your mouth, or you don't say a word. You say hi, and one of them's going to go that way. And you can see me crawling around trying to get this 1 piece that doesn't have any teeth on it anyway, right? So I'm sitting in I get up to this room, and I sit down in a chair. It's got a cushion chair, and there it is. I sat down in a chair that smells like urine. I'm in sanitized green pajamas, no teeth, sitting in a chair that smells like urine. I've got my hair up in a bun so tight I look Japanese, held with a pencil. And this old man gets up there, and he says, hee-hee-hee, what a fine bunch of monkeys we got here. And I'm thinking, what? I said, is there such a thing as patient rights? I mean, did that guy just call us monkeys? I'm not even an alcoholic, and he's calling me names. You know, thank God for hospitals and institutions, because I'm a result of that. That man that spoke was Chuck C., and it was an event. It was an event that altered the course of my life forever. I can tell you 2 things about what he said to this day. He said, 1, I stood in the doorways of my very own home, and I looked in and I saw my wife and kids, and what I saw in their eyes, I knew I'd put there, and it made me feel so bad, I needed another drink. And I remember looking in my mother's eyes, telling me, I was good with a hanger. I should have had 9 kids. I wish you'd have been the first one to go, because what had happened to her is that I had hurt her so bad with my drinking that it was impossible to love me. It was too painful. She had to hate me. It was easier. And it turned around. I remember looking at him, and something broke inside of me. There was a crack in the armor that my alcoholism had laid around me. And I got to hear about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to hear that there was a way for me to live comfortably and peacefully with myself in a world that I think I don't belong in. And that's what happened for me that day. He said that all I needed to do was stand in the doorways where sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous were gathered, and that if I didn't have the power on my own to come in, that someone would pull me in. And I believed him. Something happened to me that day that altered the course of my life forever. I was sent home to my mother that night. And for the next 3 nights, I was sicker than I'd ever been in my entire life. I couldn't sit down. I couldn't lay down. I couldn't breathe. And on that Monday, I got up and I put my mother's clothes on and her shoes and her makeup. And I went. I went to find you. Because I knew I'd be all right if I could find you. I knew it. I remember walking out the door, and my mother looked at me, and she says, where the hell are you going? And I told her, I gotta go find AA. I had an address. It was 1775 Pacific Avenue. I had to go to AA because Chuck told me I had to go there. And I had to find you because I was going to be all right if I found you. And my mother gave me 2 quarters that day. And I remember standing on the corner waiting for a bus. And when the bus pulled up, I backed off and I couldn't get back on. I couldn't get on that bus because I was afraid you would know that I was an alcoholic. Can you imagine? I walked a few blocks to that Alano Club. It was called the Pacific Alano Club, 1775 Pacific Avenue. And I remember what Chuck said, that all I needed to do was stand in the doorways where sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous were gathered. And that if you can't come in, you'll be pulled in by the love of Alcoholics Anonymous. Someone will see you and bring you in. That's what he said. And I went and stood in that doorway, and there was this old woman wiping a table. And I looked at her, and she looked at me, and I left. And I came back to that doorway one more time because I thought I got to get in there. And I looked at her and she looked at me and I took off again. And I stood on that corner of Pacific Coast Highway and Pacific Avenue. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says we stood at a turning point. And we abandoned ourselves to God as we understand God. And I looked on that corner and I saw that that's where John and I had lived. That was my corner over there. Over here was my little whorehouse where I had had my first trick. Down the street further was where I had been taken. There it was. I stood at a turning point, and I abandoned myself to you. I turned around that day, and I went to that doorway. And I stood in that doorway one more time, waiting for her to say, "Come on in." And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and she put her hand on her hip, and she said to me that day, "What do you want?" I had 2 packs of cigarettes and 1 in each hand because last time they took me without cigarettes, and that's a bad deal, let me tell you. And I said, "My name is Rachel. I am an alcoholic. They told me to come here." And she took 1 step from the middle of that room to that doorway, and she held me. And she held me, and she held me. And she said to me, "Welcome home. Welcome home. You don't ever have to live that way one day at a time if you don't want to. Come on in. Come on in. Let us give you a cup of coffee. Sit down. Take a load off." And I sat down, and Jim came from around the corner with a half a cup of coffee for me. And then I went to go open my pack of cigarettes to get his cigarettes, and all my cigarettes were broken. And he came from around the corner one more time with a pack of Cool 100s because that's what I smoked. And he opened it up, and he pulled one out, and he put it in my hand, and he held my hand and lit my cigarette for me while he held my hand so that I could smoke without too much embarrassment. And they said, "Why are you here?" And I said, "I wanted to go to AA." And they said, "Well, you're about 5 hours early." You know, my life began on that day, and I was introduced to people like you that taught me how to live one day at a time. Chuck C. used to say, and I'm going to close with this, "In him we live and move and have our being." You could feel that power that is God in these rooms. You can feel that power. I'm not so lucky. I'm not that spiritual. But I do know this, in you I live, in you I'm able to move around, in you I'm able to find and have my being, in you. I know who you are. I know who you are. I know who you are. If there is a God, you are his manifestation. In you, I will live and move and have my being. When I look in your eyes, I see the eyes of my God as you look back at me. In his hands, I feel your hands. When I am afraid and you hold my hand, I know that that is the hand of God. If you're new, hang on. Because what you have here is God as we understand God. Abandon yourself to him. That is what I did. That is what has allowed me to stay here with you one day at a time. I love you because I know who you are, and I thank you.